Hi, I'm Steve Goldstein, and this is the Friday Newscap podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
This is not a salary increase. It's just a little extra money to cover our expenses. And I defy anybody who thinks they can come down to Phoenix and live on $60 a day. It's not possible. To deny us enough money to have just a standard living while we're in session, it's not right.
As we've seen from this White House, they'll do something that seems very blustery, but it actually moves international policy. Taxing ourselves in this fashion, I'm having trouble sort of seeing how that moves Mexican policy.
And I spoke with the president of Mexico. I get along with him very well, and we made this deal. But this is something the U.S. has been trying to get for over 20 years with Mexico. They've never been able to do it. As soon as I put tariffs on the table, it was done. It took 2 days.
Basically, you have to think of members of Congress as kind of independent contractors. And in this case, one of the allegations is this former chief of staff was spending money from the congressional account, the official federal taxpayer dollars, to benefit Schweikert's campaign, which is not allowed. That would be a violation of federal law.
And with us to talk about the ongoing ethics investigation involving Congressman David Schweikert, Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego's first State of the City address, and more, are Paul Bentz of High Ground and Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizlak. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Chip, let's start off with David Schweikert at this point. 424-page report, Office of Congressional Ethics released this. How bad does this potentially look for Schweikert, even as far as public perception goes?
You know, it's never a good sign going into an election year when you're under a, quote, I'm doing air quotes now, ethics investigation. We don't know how serious the charges are, how they will be played out in the public sphere. But, you know, 424-page report is nothing to sneeze at or laugh off. The one thing that's curious is we've seen this in the history of politics where said politician throws his chief of staff under the bus, which has been a tactic that has not worked well in the past, especially if that chief of staff doesn't want to be loyal anymore and turns on their former boss. So I think it's a big deal. You know, we say money follows momentum in politics. Money also runs away from controversy. So if you look at Congressman Schweikert's bank account, it's not that thick. I actually looked yesterday. Former Congressman Matt Salmon, who's been working for ASU for quite some time, I think has a bigger campaign account still than David Schweikert right now.
Wow.
So this is good news for the Democratic challenger like Harold Tempranini, who can raise significant funds. It is a +10 Republican district. Full disclosure, I am a constituent, not involved in the campaign. But this will be a tough challenge for Schweikert.
And Paul, what surprised me is before we turn the mics on, you said you haven't had time to read the entire report. what do you make of where Schweikert's at right now?
400 pages is light reading, unfortunately. I'll try to get to it this weekend. At the end of the day, I know Chip just mentioned it's a +10 district. It's actually a +19 Republican participation district. It's a heavily Republican district. He is not vulnerable to a Democrat challenger unless this thing continues to unravel. At this point, he would be more vulnerable to, say, a Republican challenger, which nobody's come out of the woodwork to do that quite yet. But really, this is about his chief of staff, not about the congressman. And so if more information comes out, something comes to light, maybe that'll change. But for now, despite the light bank account, he's in a good spot unless a Republican decides to challenge him.
So there's no Democrat in your mind that could make this challenge worthwhile. And I mean, Tippernanny did pretty well in a pretty heavily Republican, better than others thought she might, in a pretty heavily Republican district last time around.
Right, but not this district. She was in the West Valley. No, so she's lost two times now. Carpetbagging to another district. Even in the blue wave in 2018, it was a +17 Republican participation. She would basically need to win every Democrat and every independent and get some Republicans to turn her way to win this thing. It's a really steep hill. The way our districts are set up, CD6 is not a competitive district.
Are we being unfair?
It's possible,
yeah. but are we being unfair to Anita Malik then? Because Anita Malik actually does live in that district. Is not a carpetbagger, Paul, as you labeled Tippernanny. So
yeah, I think we have a long way to go before August or November of 2020. I think a lot of this will be driven by who is a Democratic presidential candidate. I think if it's a, you know, I don't know what labels we use now, but a moderate centrist Joe Biden versus Donald Trump in Arizona with Mark Kelly on the ballot, that could drive up a lot of Democrat independent turnout. I'm not saying it's easy for a Democrat to win in Schweikert's district, but it's way too soon. We don't know if there will be, you know, hypothetically a criminal referral from this. Maybe, maybe not. And to the point about, oh, it's a chief of staff, well, it's kind of like a basketball coach. Are you in charge of your staff? Is there compliance there? Should you know what your staff is doing? That's up for debate. Some people say that. I can tell you one thing. On a campaign flyer, if you say my opponent's under criminal, you know, an ethics investigation, possibly being looked into by the FBI, whether it's, you know, totally factual or not, that can move the needle a little bit too.
In terms of that, though, I mean, like, it is his chief of staff, but he also doesn't come off looking very good in this report. I mean, there's a lot about, you know, running the office in a bad way and, like, it being, you know, there's no oversight over what other people were doing and being generally disliked also by his staff here. Does that have any effect, Paul?
Well, certainly it does. But, I mean, we're seeing the same thing with the president right now with Kellyanne Conway. I mean, it's easy to, blame the media, blame other folks, and that his constituents, the people who really like him, the conservative Republicans, are not going to care about that because it's just a witch hunt. And I think one point to note, though, is this. The blue wave was real, and it happened in 2018, and we saw massive Democrat and independent participation in 2018, but not in this district. The typical participation is plus 19. In this last cycle, it was plus 17. It is a majorly Republican district, so he can use those same tips and tricks like the president has and, you know, blame the media and other folks, and I think he'll be okay. Now, if the investigation goes further, if there's more that's revealed, if there's charges involved, then I think we could see something there. But it's just he's more vulnerable to another Republican coming in or maybe an independent. I just don't see a Democrat challenger having a shot at this.
Well, Paul, even with this report, the 424 pages and all the things that are in there, is there any consideration when it comes to David Schweikert considering, I don't know, resigning or not running for re-election? I almost feel like, not to put it all on him, but there is that sort of arrogance of certain politicians to think, I didn't really do anything wrong, or my chief of staff did it. Do people ever actually think about that and say, well, maybe this is better for my reputation, be with my family, whatever it may be?
Well, I think there's external pressure, and it depends on if, I mean, I think folks will come to him and encourage him. I don't think he's going to come to that decision on his own. But if somebody like Phoenix City Councilman Jim Waring, who's long coveted that seat, decided to jump in that race, that might make a big difference with external pressure. He's been proven to be a good fundraiser and, you know, walks through two pairs of shoes every time when he goes knocking on doors. I mean, something like that might motivate that. But in and of itself, if it's just a Democrat external challenger, I don't see that happening.
Yeah, the number one goal of most politicians is self-preservation, as we know. So I think it would take someone from the D.C. establishment saying this investigation is not going your way, David. I think it's time to wink, wink, maybe step aside and do something else with your life while we get another person in there who could probably defeat a Harald Tippernini pretty easily.
Okay.
What are the odds of that happening in terms of, you guys have any predictions if this is going to go further for him, if there will be further repercussions from this?
Well, you know, remember, this investigation started under a Republican-controlled House.
Right.
It's now a Democrat-controlled House, so they can control the levers of power. From what I've been told from my friends who have worked in congressional staffs back there, they do try to be pretty judicious with what's a criminal referral. So it really depends on where this investigation goes, the next step. Is it dismissed? Is there a criminal referral? So I think a lot's to be determined for Schweikert and his future in politics.
This is a little different than, say, Congressman Trent Franks. And this is not a personal or social issue. This is a campaign finance issue. At the end of the day, that's a big yawn. I mean, that's really unfortunately. I mean, there's real allegations here and probably a misspending of funds. There's no doubt. But at the end of the day, that's not enough to chase people off. It's going to have to be something bigger. Something more is going to have to come to light. Otherwise, I think this, even in probably the largest turnout we've ever seen, he probably wins this. It'll be closer than usual. But, I mean, Tippernini got close, but didn't win. I mean, still lost by 5 points. That's great, you know, but we hand out participation trophies in Little League, not
wow.
in congressional
Ooh.
Races.
Now, Paul, you're...
Paul needs to switch to decaf, I think. I'm just kidding.
Paul, the point about Waring's an interesting one, though, too, because Schweikert, even when he was Maricopa County Treasurer, he has run as someone who is really good with numbers, doesn't get involved in the social issues. So that's why I was wondering if there was something here, because you mentioned campaign finance being a big yawn. Yeah, for most people, but Schweikert sort of runs on stuff like that.
Sure. I mean, he does, but at the end of the day, again, he can point, it's my chief of staff, there's questions here, it's a witch hunt, you know, there's muddled messages. It's really tough to pin it on him unless some charges or something else comes out of this, because at the end of the day, it's a 400-page report. Nobody's going to take the time to read through all of that. I think the Arizona Republic article about the saying he doesn't like him and, you know, the internal office scandal makes more and better news than some report does, I think.
Okay. I think the next thing to look for is when the next campaign finance reports come out, which is the end of June, right, Paul, I think?
Yeah, I think that's right.
If Harrell Tipernini has outraised Congressman Schweikert significantly, mm-hmm. that will boost her campaign. I'm not saying it's going to matter a ton, but that will be the next, you know, thing to watch for.
And numbers do matter in congressional races, and fundraising does matter. And if his fundraising numbers are anemic, I do think that'll be time where some people might come to him and say, hey, you've got a problem here. I just – nothing's really come about yet that I think it shows that.
Well, one final thing before the break just about that district, because I also live in that district, Chip, is that the district has become, from a legislative standpoint, even more conservative. When I moved there 15 years ago or so, certainly represented by Republicans, not a surprise, but much more conservative Republicans now. So I wonder if that even brings up Paul's point about it being that much harder to defeat Schweikert, because these are – hardcore Republicans. These are not Republicans who say, oh, more funding for K-12, let me move to the left. They're not doing it.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, like a Chandler, Ahwatukee area where there's a lot of folks who work at Intel, you know, smart, well-read, well-educated. But you look along the Shea Boulevard corridor in Scottsdale, there's a lot of those people too. So it's interesting how our congressional district, our legislative district, has skewed more conservative and not to the middle. And I wonder if 2020-22 is when it goes a little more purple. Maybe not, but you have those characteristics of a Chandler and Ahwatukee.
That is Chip Scutari. Also here is Paul Bentz with Lauren Gilgram, Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. And thanks for listening to the Newscap on this Friday morning in Phoenix with Lauren Gilgram, Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are Paul Bentz of High Ground and Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizlak. I've been wondering how you got that name, Chip. But anyway, it's a very creative
name. It's a good story, but I'll save it for another time.
So let's talk a bit about the governor over the weekend. So it's been several days, deciding to veto this per diem increase, which lawmakers passed sort of in the dead of night. And some lawmakers, especially the rural ones, are not happy about this. What do you make of the reaction to this? Because some people will say, well, maybe the rural lawmakers do deserve it, but not Maricopa County.
Yeah, I'm not surprised the governor vetoed this bit of legislation. I'm glad he did. I think they should work together collaboratively next session about what makes the most sense and make sure it doesn't affect the current lawmakers that when it will go into effect after the 2020 election. And also, I know most of my friends think I'm crazy, but our state lawmakers are so underpaid. For what they do, they should make $50,000 or $60,000 a year. If you look at the scrutiny they're under and contrast it with our two U.S. senators and our congressional members, reporters know way more about what your state senator is doing down there. They deserve more money, and I think the per diem issue can be worked out next session.
Well, Paul, that actually begs the question I was not going to ask, which is if, in fact, as we've talked about this before, if they were making $50,000 or $60,000, would we have more competitive primaries? Would we have potentially better candidates?
I think so. The problem is every time it goes before the voters, they always vote it down. The challenge here is they should not have done something to benefit themselves. Nobody should ever vote themselves a pay increase. You should have waited till the next legislative session, should have done it prospectively and had a more transparent process. You mentioned it, dead of night. Nobody's going to support a pay increase in the dead of night. But the challenge here is that if you live outside Maricopa County, it was a 135-day session at $185 a day. They made almost $25,000. They almost doubled their salary. So it's not that they, you know, they can cry the poorhouse here, but there's really a little bit of a challenge. But the big challenge is, so Gila Bend is in Maricopa County. It's 68 miles away from the capital. Apache Junction, on the other hand, if, depending on where you live in Apache Junction, you could be in Pinal County and get the per diem, and you're only 37 miles away. What we really should be talking about is some sort of distance from the capital or some other way besides the county designation to feel this. But it should be a transparent process. There's changes that need to be made. Our legislators should be paid more. But they should do this in the light of day with everybody involved and make it more transparent.
One other really basic point, but I don't want to sound like a condescending know-it-all, but they all got elected to office knowing what the pay was, knowing what the per diem was. And I understand it's tough for rural lawmakers, but that's what you signed up for. Sorry, you know. Yeah.
Is there a sense among lawmakers that they could do this differently? Like, why did they go about it this way? Did they think that no one's ever going to approve a pay increase for us otherwise, so let's just slam it in there while we can? There's no other option?
I think there's a little bit of that. I also think there's a little bit of conflict with the governor right now, and I think that was a hangover from the budget process and not really being upset about the process themselves and being there in the dead of night saying, we don't get paid enough to do this. And so I think we saw a little bit of that, but they got to find a way to work together. There's some strained relationships right now between the governor's office and the legislature.
And I thought when I heard about this issue, I thought this was going to be part of the budget negotiation. Hey, governor, you want this, you know, you're going to raise our per diem, but they didn't even do that. So they were outfoxed by the governor and his staff. It wasn't even a horse trade at all. It was just a bill after the budget. So I didn't really understand the strategy.
It's okay if neither of you know the answer to this, but how does this work in other states? Do lawmakers in other states make a significantly more amount of money?
Yeah, I know in California they do. There's no perfect system, because you don't want professional lawmakers. But we pay our state lawmakers based on, back in the agricultural days when, men had to go back to tend to their farms. I mean, it's totally different. But every state's different. Some have more, some have less. And a lot of my friends will say, you pay them more, it's not going to matter. I personally think it will widen the talent pool and be a lot better because there's not many people who can go from January to June almost full time and then go back to another life. You just can't do it.
I'm going
to
borrow Chip's air quotes for a minute. Allegedly, this is a quote-unquote part-time job.
Right.
And it's not. I mean, it is a full-time job, and we do need to increase the pay for legislators. I think I don't think the regular voters understand really what is involved with how much power the legislature has, how much is involved with their participation, how much more they have to do beyond the session. It's really, I mean, the President Fan mentioned that they want to start working on the budget after Labor Day this year for next year's budget. So, I mean, I think there's a lot to this, and I mean, I think they should get paid more. The challenge is they got to make the sale to the voters on this.
Okay, guys, let's move on to Mayor Kay Gallego's first State of the City address as mayor of Phoenix. In a few minutes, we're going to hear sit-down interview Lauren actually did with Mayor Gallego. Both of you guys, I know, have some involvement in light rail to some extent, but I want to talk about that. That's an issue she decided to jump in on pretty without real safety. I mean, this was not dipping her toe in the water. Chip, what do you think? That was fairly aggressive that she showed support for light rail.
Yeah, full disclosure, our firm proudly works with Scott Smith and Valley Metro, but I was super impressed with Mayor Gallego. She went right in. She's a passionate advocate, not just of rail, but of mass transit in general, of what it's done for a region economically, connecting people. And I think she made a really strong sales pitch while people should vote no on Prop 105 in August. And she didn't beat around the bush. It was very well. I thought the speech itself was very well written, very well deserved, delivered. And as you look around the room, sometimes you're at those political speeches and people are looking at their watches, looking at the phone, like, when's this thing going to end? I think she captured people's attention to the very end. It was very well done.
Okay.
It was an incredibly strong inaugural State of the State speech or State of the City speech. I think she did a great job. I heard one comment she reminded people of cinema. Like, she was poised, thoughtful, very commanding of, very well messaged. But her support of transit, her support of the city is longstanding. She was the face and the chairman of the Prop 104 campaign for the Transit 2050. She's been there before. It's not a surprise that she stood up there. But really, at the end of the day, she stood up for 30 years of transportation planning and three votes of the people. She is on the side of angels on this issue and is really, she's right. And I think she did a good job, kept it brief, kept it thoughtful, did pay some homage to some of her more conservative members of the council. But You know, she's right. We should not let a dark money group destroy Phoenix by singling out one thing they don't like.
Do we know where this stands at this point? Like what the polls are showing about this upcoming vote on light rail? Because this could be a really big upset if it goes the other way.
Yeah, it could be devastating. I think the private polling I've heard about has been pretty strong for light rail.
Yeah.
Just the connectivity, just all the benefits to the region. I think when people know that we've approved this three times, that I think we could lose up to $3 billion in federal funds that could go to other cities. And that this is, it's so important people know this isn't a South Central issue, just about the South Central extensions. This is about all light rail extensions, losing that federal dollars. And it's not an either or proposition. I know the opponents say, oh, well, it's cut light rail funding, we'll put it in the streets. There's $8 billion for streets and roads over the next 30 years. So it's not an either-or proposition.
The polling I've seen shows that light rail is incredibly popular. People want it. Now that it's here to stay. That issue is settled. We are not going to continue to litigate whether or not light rail should exist. So this idea of just unilaterally getting rid of it and stopping it from here on out is not popular from everything that I've seen. But it does take a fight because people don't know, as Chip mentioned, that the proponents say it's an either-or proposition. It is not. There's plenty of money to fund Phoenix's streets, but they try to make it an either-or proposition, which is a challenge they have to face.
And so let me jump in with one quick thing, which is not related to Mayor Gallego, but what about this quote where someone said that former Congressman, the late Ed Pastor, the fact that he supported light rail is the reason he died at the age. I mean, when it comes to that kind of rhetoric, how does that hurt a cause?
Yeah, I mean, it was from a light rail opponent. I don't know the lady. It was despicable, and I feel horrible for Congressman Pastor's family, especially Councilwoman Laura Pastor. It was just, it was terrible. Unfortunately for the anti-light rail crowd, they're going to be stained with that now forever. But it was just completely despicable and uncalled for and unnecessary.
Yeah, Paul, you've been involved in dirty campaigns. I don't mean from your side, of course. No. I mean campaigns that get dirty. Sorry about that.
Right.
Didn't mean it like that. Phrase that very quickly, yes.
Hit the nail on the head. It's despicable. It's a despicable comment. It doesn't involve it should not be in this political theater here. I've been in meetings where women have done cartwheels over the support of transit. I mean, transit discussions get a little wacky to begin with, but this is so beyond the pale, it's unbelievable.
One last question about Mayor Gallego then, having sat down with her, and I agree with your assessment of the speech. What does this say in the political circles that are talking about it right now about her, the tone she's setting for, the next several years she'll have in office and what she's aiming to do here?
I mean, I think her speech reflected what her first term will be. She's very smart, strategic, organized, very strategic about where she wants to take the city, very hardworking. She's got a lot of, as I think Paul mentioned, a lot of characteristics of Senator Sinema. I mean, just really off the charts, smart, organized, know where they want to go, pragmatic, though. Not far left, not far right, kind of going down the centrist path.
She's got an incredibly bright future. I think that the speech indicates that. It'll be interesting to see if she's able to wrangle this new council. The council is a pretty diverse group mm-hmm. with a wide range of opinions all the way from incredibly progressive to incredibly conservative. So she's got some navigating to do, but I do think she set the right tone.
All right, that is Paul Bentz of High Ground, Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizzlight. Guys, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's big stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at theshow@kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein, and thanks for listening.